Ooh.
Isn't it pretty?
I like.
Well, this one's like breaking. Like it's starting to separate. So I was like, before it fully breaks off, I'm going to buy myself a new one.
Like me with my glasses.
Yeah.
See how they're looking? Like.
Do you like my new glasses?
Yeah, I was going to ask if those too. Were your new ones.
Yeah, I have blue and I have pink.
My new ones shipped this morning.
Yay.
All three pairs.
Can I have the
I hope they're good.
Paper? I'm not going to start right this second, but how?
Okay, guys, we're going to go ahead and warn you. Texas is long on all sides.
Literally on all sides.
Oh, yeah. So,
No, mine is these two, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's...
Oh, it's a dual.
It's a dual.
Okay.
We have our first dual missing person.
Well, let me... Because you just tried to introduce and I talked right over you.
You're fine.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah.
Hi, I'm Alicia.
And this is...
Sinister States. And we're snacking.
Yeah. Alicia's still eating. So if you hear food, well, she needs to eat. She's a human being. So... If you don't like it,
I'm just snacking.
I apologize, like, but I'm not going to make her starve.
Listen, we do this, and you're still going to get my expressions. You'll hear it in the middle of my snacking.
Yeah. But, hi, everybody. We are on a new week, which means we're in a new state, and we are in the state of Texas. And we will not be going into any politics around Texas right now.
Right.
If you have opinions, cool. We're here to bring you true crime, not true life. This is Texas.
Yeah.
Not because we don't have opinions on it or we don't know about it. Alicia just enlightened me to a lot of stuff. Just we're not here for that. So today is February 3rd, if you're wondering what we're talking about. So this will come out in March, like the first week of March, I think.
Yep.
First or second week. But I'm sure the discussions will have still been ongoing and things are still happening. So anyway, we will be covering Texas.
Yep.
I'm covering this one and then Alicia will cover us on Thursday.
Yes. We're in Texas.
Everything's bigger in Texas, including the number of pages that we needed in order to
complete
the research for these. Because
I really cut mine down a lot.
I didn't. This is the synopsis version of mine. This is the Wikipedia version. What I mean by that is some of this is taken from Wikipedia because Wikipedia is shorter. But for fair warning, this one is going to be longer than you typically hear me talk. I have 17 pages of notes. So if that sounds intimidating, I mean, don't think I don't feel it. But anyway, how are you? How's your food?
It's great.
I like how we just slowly, like, eat throughout this at this
yeah,
point.
Yeah, we're just like...
Like, I just finished mine during the last recording.
Yeah.
And now you're gonna eat. Do you like Zorro's toys all over my office?
You're a mom.
You see that chicken?
Mm-hmm.
He's had that chicken since the day we brought him home. He's never destroyed it or anything.
I can tell he's had that chicken for a minute. Look at his little face.
Always nasty, but he hasn't destroyed it at all, and I'm so proud.
Of him because my dogs.
And then that toy, I took all the little pieces away, the little blue one over there. It has ears and arms and a tail, but he's getting so big that I got nervous that if he... Because they're meant to pull them off. It's like really strong Velcro. I got nervous that he would pull it off and then choke on it. So the little arms and legs and tail are in a drawer.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. But.
So, no, we're making it. I'm making it here. It's been a long week.
It has been a week.
So.
Well, let me just tell you, I'm so happy that it's the weekend. Although next week is just going to be just as hectic for me. You know.
We're having Ethan's birthday party next weekend at my mom's house. So,
yeah.
And Ethan does not have school Thursday and Friday of next week, so I have to take him Wednesday night to my mom's house.
Dang.
So next week is going to be a little hectic for me too, because I got a call. What? I got a call in order. It's cake.
Yeah.
I'm making some cakes.
You're
some cupcakes.
Save me a cupcake. What kind are you making? I love your cupcakes, because the last ones you made, the like apple-filled ones, those were delightful.
So... My kid has requested a cherry cupcake.
Like cherry flavored or with cherry filling?
He wants a cherry. Like, he didn't specify. He just said he wanted a cherry flavored cake.
Okay.
So, mommy here, I'm going to take some regular vanilla cake mix.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm going to cut up some maraschino cherries and use the cherry juice in place of like the water.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds fine. Are you going to make frosting out of the flavoring too? Like the juice? Yeah.
Gonna make some cherry frosting, and so we're gonna have
That's like
cherry.
that's a flavor you don't hear kids like a lot.
Yeah, my
That's
kid
cool.
loves anything cherry.
That's awesome.
So we're doing cherry cupcakes, and then instead of me trying to make some big spectacular cake and then have to travel with it to North Carolina, I'm just gonna make the cupcakes at home, and then I'm gonna order a Spider-Man cake, a 10-inch cake from Sam's Club for like $16.
Hey,
If
it's gonna
even
get the
that.
job done.
And I'm gonna get a marble cake, so it's gonna be chocolate and vanilla together.
That sounds good.
That way, if you don't like cherry, you can eat chocolate or vanilla.
Yeah.
And we're doing his birth, like my son's birthday is not until the 27th, and we're doing his party the 10th at my mom's house. And the reason we're doing it so early is Willa has surgery on the 14th. She's having her little tonsils removed. So we didn't
On
want to.
Valentine's Day?
Funny story though, when Ethan had his tonsils removed, they were removed on Valentine's Day as well. And it wasn't anything planned. Like they didn't get to pick the day. The doctor said Valentine's Day is the next appointment we have
Willow's
open.
what, five? Yeah.
Ethan was five too.
Yeah.
So,
Just following in her cousin's footsteps.
yeah.
Aww.
So we're having his party early at grandma's
That'll be fun, though.
so that Willowoo can come and enjoy the party.
She'll probably bounce right back after having her
Yeah,
tonsils
well,
out.
so Ethan had his tonsils taken out. He did fine, but he did get COVID from the surgical center.
Yeah, you told me about that.
So, and it was a couple weeks before he wanted to actually eat like a lot of like the regular food. He wanted to eat kind of soft things the first couple weeks, and so we were like, we want her to be able to eat pizza and have fun, so we're just doing it early.
Yeah.
Which Ethan's excited because now he's like, "Ooh, I get to get my presents early."
Yeah.
But he's not getting the presents from me and his daddy early. I'm sorry.
He's
He
gonna
does
be
not
what,
get
9? Yeah.
9 going on 30. Yeah.
Your baby is almost in double digits. I don't know what's worse, the fact that I'm saying that he's almost in double digits, or the fact that you and Scott, or you keep reminding Scott that you're almost half done with
My
the
kid.
legal portion of it.
I am almost half done with the legal, like, it's scary. And
Your obligation.
a lot of work went into Ethan too, let me tell you. I grew him, and that was the hardest thing I've ever been through.
That sounds like something I never want to do, so thank you.
Growing a human is
That
hard.
sounds
There's like,
no, thank you.
I mean, it was a good experience,
I don't know.
but the
I
end.
don't know. I've sat there. I'm not judging, because
Yeah.
that's beautiful, because I wouldn't be here if my mom didn't do that for me. So I can appreciate the
The
growing of a
mamas.
human. However, you cannot pinpoint a specific time between conception to 18 years of age that there is a good point in raising a child. You cannot give me one, because I will give you a reason why that time period sucks specifically.
Why is that?
No, just, and it's just, I'm just saying, like, the entire experience just sounds like a nope from me. Literally from
Oh.
conception to the time that they're 18, and even beyond that, because I mean, your kid is
Yeah.
your kid for life. It's just they become part of the adult world when they're 18.
Yeah.
And I've tried to be like, okay, well, because Lewis and I have talked about very briefly, we don't talk about it really anymore, is potentially adopting a child from the
Yeah.
system. But I can't pinpoint a specific age where I would be comfortable, like, yeah, I could raise a child from said age because this stage is over. Because there's so many different
Oh,
stages,
no.
and all of them come with their own set of issues and trials and
Well, I'm sure you
tribulations.
can see with Zorro that it doesn't matter whether it's a kid or an animal, you have all different kinds of trials and tribulations with
Yeah.
them.
But I appreciate the mamas out there. Like I said, I would not be here today without mine. So I can appreciate it. I just cannot relate. And it just sounds like a nope. But I'm gonna leave it to the professionals,
Listen,
because
that's
that's not gonna
okay.
be me.
And no, it's not like, and that's the thing, like, parenthood is ultimately up to you whether you want to be a parent or not.
It
You
doesn't look
want to be
easy.
childless, and I totally support you on that.
I just want to be the cool auntie, which I am. To
Well,
everybody
and
else's
that's
children.
totally fine. And Scott and I, maybe one day we might try to foster kids
Yeah.
or maybe foster to adopt one.
I do love me a good child I can give back. We don't hate children, Lewis and I. Like, I don't hate kids. I don't think that they should cease to exist. I just don't want it one under my
Seriously, like, I don't
responsibility.
want that those responsibilities, as Chucky says, and Tommy.
Responsibilities. I don't want responsibilities no more. But no, I really don't. It's just, it sounds way too difficult
Some
and
people are
daunting.
kid people, some people are not
Oh no,
kid
I'm a
people.
kid person when I can give them back. Because when
Right.
I'm tired, I call up the mom or the daddy. I'm like, and then they come, and then it leaves, and it's quiet in my house.
Happens. It's totally cool. Get
But
that.
I love Ethan. He's gonna be 9. I can't believe it.
My little nugget.
Dude, we've been friends for like a year. A year!
Was thinking about that.
Because we met officially last January at the women's conference with Leanne and Kelly and everybody. So it's been a year. And
Been a
then we
year.
got really close in May after the gym opened.
Yeah, because we started going together.
Literally day one. Like we were there together. But yeah. And then we got Zorro and then my accident, and I just have fallen off the bandwagon. But I'm gonna come back eventually.
Don't do that elliptical backwards.
I won't. I didn't plan to do the elliptical forwards either for a while. But anyway, hi everybody.
Right.
Did I did
We did our intro.
Okay.
Pretty sure we did. Yeah, we did.
We did. Yeah,
We just
because you were
squirreled.
eating.
Yeah, we just squirreled.
Okay. Well, as stated, we're in Texas, so I'm gonna start off with our missing persons. And in this case it is a plural, so this is two different people. I'm assuming they're brother and sister. And their names are AJ Campbell Jr. and Myresha Faye Campbell. Both of them have been missing since September 6th, 1958. AJ Campbell Jr. was a white male. Well, might be a white male still. Don't know. Date of birth, September 20th, 1957, which would make him 66 years old today. He went missing at the age of 11 months old. At the time, he was 2'2" and 25 pounds. He was last seen wearing a faded yellow cloth diaper with a clear plastic liner over it and a light blue and white checkered shirt with a dark blue collar. Distinguishing characteristics: Caucasian male with blonde hair and blue eyes. AJ has a birthmark on his eyelid and a birthmark below his lower lip, and his thumbs are clubbed at the ends. And then his sister, also missing since September 6th, 1958. She was born, this is Myresha Faye. She was also a white female born March 2nd, 1955, which would make her 68 years old, almost 69. She was 3 years old when she went missing.
Sorry.
You're fine. I paused so I can cut it out.
Oh, okay.
She was 2'6" and 28 pounds. She was last seen wearing a pink Orlan fabric dress with a Peter Pan collar, a gathered skirt and puffed sleeves, pink silk panties, pink nylon stretch socks, nylon, why did I say that? Nylon stretch socks, white buckled shoes with a Paul's Shoes label visible inside, and a gold bracelet on her right arm. Some distinguishing characteristics for her, there aren't many. She was a Caucasian female with dark blonde hair and blue eyes. They are both considered endangered missing out of Goliad, Texas, or Goliad, Texas. And the associated vehicle is a pink and charcoal gray 1955 Chevrolet Tudor with the Texas license plate number MA9996. This was an accounted for vehicle, but let's see what's going on. So AJ and his sister Myresha were last seen in Goliad, Texas on September 6th, 1958. They lived with their mother, Jewel Bernay Campbell, and the children's father, AJ Campbell Sr., took them for a ride and never returned with them. Never returned them. Photographs of both the children's parents are posted with this case summary. They had been married for 8 years, and AJ was very abusive towards Jewel. She took the children and left him, supporting herself with a teaching job in Goliad, Texas. AJ Sr. had court-ordered visitation times with them on Saturdays, and it was during one of those visits that they disappeared. He took them at 9 a.m. and was supposed to bring them back by 3 p.m. William Randall Jr., an acquaintance of AJ Sr., was the last person to see the children besides their father. Randall stated he and AJ Sr. picked up the children in Goliad, then drove away in Randall's two-door pink and charcoal gray 1955 Chevrolet Tudor with the Texas license plate number MA9996. They went through Ciro, Texas, and Gonzales, Texas, stopping along the way to pick up two large cans of lard. When they were about 3 miles outside Goliad, AJ Sr. asked Randall to stop because he wanted to see a friend. Randall stopped and got out of the car, and AJ drove on without him, with both children inside the vehicle. About 30 to 40 minutes later, AJ returned to pick up Randall. The children were no longer with him. He said he'd gone to visit his brother-in-law, but they had a fight, and he wound up leaving the children with another relative. AJ seemed nervous and agitated at the time, asked if he had any blood on him, and warned Randall to tell no one about the fight. They drove to San Antonio, Texas, and then separated. AJ was supposed to meet Randall at a bus station at midnight the next day to return the car, but he never showed up. Randall took a bus to Fort Worth, Texas, and then reported his car as stolen. The following day, AJ Sr. spoke to a Fort Worth, Texas minister on the telephone that day and implied that he had killed his children, saying they were at rest with the world and that he was going to kill himself. Early on September 7th, AJ Sr.'s body was later found inside Randall's vehicle on a rural road near Austin, Texas. His death was ruled a suicide. He had shot himself in the head with a new 16-gauge shotgun. He left a note addressed to Jewel. The note said he had buried both children and that he loved the children and he loved Jewel and hoped she would be happy. There was no indication of the children's whereabouts and no trace of them could be found. Jewel remarried after AJ's death and took the name Robertson and had two more children. She died in 2013. Her children by her second marriage, Regina Meinig and Phil Robertson, have been active in the search for AJ Jr. and Myresha and hope that they may be located. They believe there's a chance that the children are alive and AJ Sr. gave or sold them to someone instead of killing them. The bodies of Myresha and AJ have never been found and their cases remain open.
That's the reason why I chose that one, because I feel like there's a very good potential that he just sold them to somebody, because they were young enough that...
Yeah, they were three and 11 months old.
Like, you could easily give them to somebody and they not know who.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I mean, especially back in the 50s and the 60s, come on.
Yeah, dude, you heard all the time about people selling their kids.
Ric Flair.
He sold his children?
No, Ric Flair is a child that was...
Sold?
Like, he was part of a, one of those big, like, rings of, oh, who was it? It was a lady, like.
Wasn't that child farming?
Yeah.
Or whatever? Where they would end up in an orphanage or something? Or yeah, she was selling them,
like, Georgia something or another.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of her, like, one of the
she
kids.
She was a baby farmer, right?
Basically, yeah. Hold on, let's see.
Didn't she steal children to sell them? Like, from, like, unfit mothers or people that she deemed to be unfit?
Yeah, like, if she was part of... Yeah, he said, I was stolen from an orphanage.
That's wild. I did not know that about
Yeah,
Ric Flair.
I'm trying to think of... It was... So he, like, he actually knew what his... it says, soon after birth, Flair was taken... from his mother and placed in Tennessee's Children's Home Society.
Hmm.
And it was a Memphis branch operator, Georgia Tan, who later discovered to have kidnapped children and put them up for adoption. He was part of her ring.
Oh my gosh. Imagine being connected to that. Poor Ric Flair. Is that his real name?
So that is his adopt, like... I think so. He had an actual birth name too.
Oh.
Because where she had. So his name is Richard Morgan Flair, and it's spelled F L I E H R, but he's known as Flair, F L A I R.
Yeah.
But he had, they had told at one point his actual name. He was born February 25th, 1949. And his birth name is commonly considered to be Fred Phillips.
Interesting.
Yep.
Well, that's insanity. I did not know that. Where the heck's my Texas?
Anyways, that's it. Okay, I'm preparing.
You better get ready. You better get a pillow because you're about to fall asleep.
I'm not going to fall asleep. I'm excited to hear this.
This is 17 pages.
Mine's only 5.5. So.
Well, if I stumble over
I mean, it was originally 11, and I really cut mine down. I got mine to concise.
I
I'm
tried.
actually going to take this off.
This case is bigger than I thought. So this, so I
Too.
changed this a couple times and I settled on this one, not because it was long, but because it was interesting. So this is going to be the murder of Joey Fisher.
Joey Fisher.
No words, no idea,
No
nothing.
idea.
Me neither. Okay.
I almost
So
did the Candy Man.
I know. And then
He his stuff
and
was
then you
well.
changed it.
Well, I start, yeah.
Well, I hope this is not the Candy Man.
I don't think that
I
is.
don't think so. I
I'm
didn't
a
see
panic
any
girl.
recollection to the Candyman in this, but All right. So, a little backstory. So, Albert Joseph Fisher Jr., aka Joey, was born in Brownsville, Texas on January 16th, 1975. His parents were AJ Fisher, aka Buddy, and Corrine Nelson. The couple divorced in 1987 and remarried separately. Fisher lived with his mother and his stepfather, Vernon Nelson, aka Bo. And he was a senior honor student at St. Joseph's Academy, a Catholic private school in Brownsville. He had a 98.5 grade point average, was ranked 11th in his class, and was going to attend the honors program at the University of Texas at Austin on graduation. At 18
Dang.
years old, At 18 years old, he enjoyed basketball and was a fan of the Los Angeles Lakers, loved computers, and talked about pursuing a career as an engineer. Along with two other classmates, he was voted most sarcastic by his high school class and was known for sometimes acting foolish and having a good sense of humor. He was also often attracted to the more Latina girls of the school, which don't ask me what that has to do with anything, but it does, I guess. During his junior year, he
He had
dated
a
Chris.
preference.
Yeah. During his junior year, he dated Christina, who was a year younger than him. Most of Fisher's friends described her as a quiet, although some said she was only reserved with people that she did not know. Christina's mother, Dora Garcia Cisneros, and I apologize if that's not how you say it, I'm just saying it how it's spelled, approved of Fisher's relationship with her daughter and thought he was potentially a good candidate for marriage.
Jesus.
And mind you, these kids are like 16, 17 years
That's what I was
old.
gonna say. She's getting them ready for the long haul.
So in Cisneros' eyes, Fisher was an overachieving student from a good family and wasn't wild like many of the other St. Joe boys. Cisneros herself grew up in a well-off ranching family from Los Indios, Texas, and was married to David Cisneros, a surgeon from Brownsville. They had five children. She was a well-respected volunteer in the local medical community and was president of the Southern chapter of the Cameron Willacy County's Medical Society. The association where she volunteered helped raise funds for medical scholarships. In addition, people close to Cisneros said that she was a practicing Catholic and that she cared a lot for her family. She volunteered at St. Joe and was well-liked in the social group she was a part of. Since Los Indios was mostly a ranching community close to a U.S.-Mexico border, Cisneros' religiosity was heavily influenced by Surrenderismo, a practice of religious and folk medicine medicine healing rooted in ancient Mexican culture. All right. In Matamoros and Brownsville, Curanderos, I apologize, I don't speak Spanish at all. Curanderos, practitioners of Curanderismo. I don't speak Spanish, I'm
I
sorry.
know you, the way you just said that, you're like, I'm so sorry, but I don't speak Spanish. And I'm over here every day struggling with English. It's all good.
They offered works of white and black magic. These services are known as Brujeria or witchcraft in England.
Brujah.
Brujeria, is that how you say it?
Well, I know that
Well, that would make sense.
the Spanish word for witch is brujah.
So it's probably Brujeria because it's Brujeria.
Yeah.
Brujeria, okay. People consult healers and fortune tellers for help with relationships, to revive their romance, to end a marriage, to make someone fall in love, or to hurt someone.
No.
People also consult them to drive away negative energy, predict the future and dangerous events, to improve their health, or to bring positive energy. Cisneros grew closer to Curanderismo after her firstborn David died after being thrown from a moving vehicle by a friend while he attended St. Joe as a student in 1974. The way you whipped around. Yes, her son, her firstborn son David was he died after being thrown from a moving car. This wasn't a baby. He was in school, but
Oh,
he
okay. Never mind. Okay, got it. Got it.
Yeah, it says it's while he attended St. Joe as a student in 1974. People close to Cisneros described her as a person who endured several tragic events growing up. One of her uncles committed suicide when she was young, and her brother drowned as a teenager. But several others who were close to her maintained that after her son died, Cisneros started to show signs of insanity and became more protective of her children and began visiting local curanderas. Curanderas? Yep. All right, so I'm going to go into Joey Fisher and his actual girlfriend, Christina, who is the daughter of, I lost her first name. I'm so sorry. Dora Cisneros. So her daughter's Christina, she's Dora, and then Joey's the boyfriend of Christina. Okay, so Fisher and Christina often did outdoor activities together, but Fisher's stepmother thought that they were only friends. She said that she never saw them hold hands or behave in a way that suggested intimacy. According to his friends, Fisher went with Christina to South Padre Island, Texas, during spring break and had sex with her in her parents' condominium. They said that he did not brag about it and, in fact, seemed to regret his decision. Christina denied this ever happened. Later that year, they attended St. Joe's prom together. In June of 1992, Fisher broke up with Christina. He told one of his friends that their relationship was only physical and he did not feel an emotional attachment to her. Fisher had given Christina his ring while they were dating, and once they broke up, he asked her to return it, but Christina refused. During the first weeks of summer, Cisneros called Fisher several times and asked... Okay, so throughout this, if I say Cisneros, that's their last name. That's the mom. Christina is the daughter. So, to keep them separate. Cisneros called Fisher several times and asked him why he had broken up with her daughter. He told her Christina was very kind, but he wanted to be single and date other girls. Cisneros then called Fisher's father, Buddy, and asked him why his son had broken up with Christina.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Fisher was angry that Christina did not return his ring and wrote a letter to her saying that he wanted his ring in 10 days or he would take action. Cisneros then called Buddy and told him she wanted to talk about his son's ring and other things. Both agreed to meet at a Burger King. Cisneros asked Buddy why Fisher broke up with Christina, and Buddy said that that was between his son and her. He said his son was old enough to make his own decisions and that he would not get involved. Cisneros then asked him if he knew Fisher drank, and he responded that at his son's age, it was not uncommon to drink. Cisneros then said she had seen Fisher drunk once before, but his father responded by saying if he had been drunk before, it was not in his presence. Sex never came up in the conversation. Buddy told Cisneros he would speak to his son about acting like a gentleman. Cisneros promised to return Fisher's ring. Buddy recalled the meeting was awkward but friendly. Buddy returned home and told Fisher to apologize to Christina if he had offended her and to tell her that they should be friends. It is not known if he took his father's advice, but according to one of Fisher's friends, Cisneros continued to call him after her meeting with his father.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
She's like the psycho ex-girlfriend that just can't get rid of.
She's wild.
Except she's the mom.
Yeah. One of his friends stated that Fisher said Cisneros had offered him $500 to get back with her daughter, but he refused.
Oh my gosh!
Fisher grew angry at Cisneros' insistence that he rekindle his relationship with Christina and eventually called her and told her to stop. Once Fisher's senior year started, he began to date a new girl. I'm going to butcher this. I'm sorry. Marianella Caballero?
What's it look like? It's little. I'm sorry.
You're fine.
Marianella Caballero?
Marianella Cabarello. Cabrello?
Sorry,
Cabrello.
We don't speak Spanish.
Marianella Cabrello. Listen, I just knew what a brewha was because I've heard it before. I just don't want to be rude. I know it's probably not that difficult, but I don't have the tongue rolling skills of the Spanish language on my side. Anyway,
he did give warning that he liked Latino women, though. That's part of
it. I'm so sorry.
You gave warning.
I did.
We're going to be butchering names. That's all good.
I'm just going to call her Marianella. He invited her to the homecoming dance, but they did not date for the first semester because Marianella did not want any commitments. However, by the start of their second semester, they did begin dating. Around that same time, Christina also started dating another boy. Fisher told his friends that he was fine with Christina dating other boys. Then, on Wednesday, March 3rd, 1993, in Rancho Viejo, Texas, an affluent community just north of Brownsville, Fisher woke up early to get ready for school. Just before 7 a.m., he went to the garage and reversed his mother's car into the circular driveway at his home at 3 Cortez Avenue. He then walked toward the corner of the house and grabbed a garden hose to spray water on the car's windows, which were covered in dust. As he sprayed the car, someone came from behind and shot him twice at point-blank range with what would later be identified as a .38 super pistol. One of the shots penetrated his chest and the other his brain. Fisher's mother looked out the window to see what had happened, thinking the noise came from one of the house's palm tree branches falling on the roof, or that the car had backfired. She did not see the car, and thought that perhaps her son had gone to a convenience store to pick up something, but Fisher's brother Eric told her he could see the car parked on the driveway. She went to the garage and saw Fisher's body lying face up on the driveway. She told her daughter Kathy to call 911 and her father, Buddy, who lived a few minutes away. Buddy dressed and headed toward the house. He took a shortcut off Texas Highway 77 and 83 to reach the house and recalled going over 110 miles per hour at some point and brushing off a few cars along the way by gesturing with his left hand. Once he reached Rancho Viejo, he ignored the entrance and drove instead through a field of palm trees. As he drew closer to Fisher's house, he heard police sirens at a distance. When he arrived, he saw his son's body holding a garden hose. The water running had covered the entire roadway with Fisher's blood. Witnesses, including Eric, recall seeing a short, bearded Hispanic man in his mid-20s driving a white four-door vehicle with Mexican license plates speeding away after the attack. Kathy then phoned one of Fisher's closest friends before school started and asked him if he knew if Fisher had any enemies. Fisher's friend could not think of anyone who disliked him and only recalled that he and Fisher had been in an altercation with a group of boys at a football game. The evening before Fisher's burial, over 600 people attended a Catholic service at St. Mary's Church in Brownsville. His parents decided to have an open casket to allow attendees to kneel and pray next to the coffin. The funeral took place in the same church. Many people were in attendance, including Buddy and Corrine's acquaintances and Fisher's high school classmates. His girlfriend Marianella and her mother attended both services. Christina, his ex-girlfriend, was also at the services, but her mother was not present. Fisher was buried at the Mont Meta Memorial Park in San Benito, Texas. In the days after the funeral, several of Fisher's longtime friends and their parents gathered at Buddy's house for moral support. Fisher's family moved out of the house where he was killed and went to live with Corrine's mother. The day of the murder, the Brownsville police offered a reward of $5,000 to anyone who could assist in the arrest of any individual involved in the murder. A week later, the reward was increased to $20,000, and 5 months after the murder, Fisher's house was sold at an $18,000 loss.
Wow. Well, I mean, it probably was hard to sell, like, out of fear because they hadn't caught who the killer was. Like, I wouldn't want to buy that house either.
Yeah. So, initially, police believed that the murder was a drive-by shooting, but investigators discovered a tennis shoe print near the outdoor air conditioning unit and a yellow business card next to Fisher's body. Though the business card was stained by blood from Corrine's hands after she tried to stop the bleeding, investigators were able to decipher the wording on the card. It was from the Collin County Bail Office in McKinney, Texas. A phone number was printed on the card, and it had a handwritten area code, 214, from the Dallas area. Alex Perez, the former sheriff of Cameron County, who was appointed to lead the investigation, called the bail office and asked them to fax copies of bond applications made by Rio Grande Valley residents. The police theorized that the assailant had dropped the card after Fisher tried to defend himself. The bail office faxed the police several applications and included one from Rudy, I can never say this last name, it's C-U-E-L-L-A-R. I think it's Sular, but I don't speak Spanish.
What is it?
C-U-E-L-L-A-R.
Kind of looks like seller, but I know it's not pronounced that way, probably.
Apologies. Y'all can yell at me on Facebook and tell me how to pronounce it. But I'm going to say Rudy Sueller, a Dallas resident who often visited Mexico. That morning, the police interrogated Fisher's girlfriend, Marianella, at the sheriff's office. They asked her if she had ever had cross words with Christina. She said that she had never even talked to her, though she was confused why they would ask about his ex-girlfriend. Cisneros was also interrogated, but the police found nothing unusual about her behavior, only that she was nervous and had left her car keys inside her vehicle. Later that day, Christina went to Buddy's house and offered her condolences. The police did not treat Cisneros' connection to Fisher any differently than the rest of the leads. They knew of Cisneros' calls, but they did not think it was suspicious enough to rule the murder a crime of passion. His stepfather initially thought that the murder was tied to a legal dispute over a contract worth thousands of dollars he had with a Chinese shrimp firm based in Arroyo City, Texas, just north of Brownsville, that he had terminated. The police began to investigate this lead and told Fisher's family that they were probably in danger. For about 2 weeks, they rarely left their house, and his parents considered sending Kathy and Eric to San Antonio, Texas, where their grandparents lived.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Given the high-profile nature of the case, the police received several tips from citizens. Police theorized that Fisher was killed by a drug gang that had mistaken him for someone else. They questioned a man alleged to be the intended victim, but the rumors turned out to be false. They also investigated an abandoned vehicle near the U.S.-Mexico border they suspected was used in the shooting. The car was reported stolen in South Padre Island, but detectives determined that it was not the vehicle the murderers used. The police continued to pursue the lead from the bail office in McKinney. They called the office and asked for recent bail applications from South Texas locations. The office gave them Sueller's full name, his Dallas address, and faxed a copy of the application. Investigators noticed that the man's handwriting, specifically how the four was written, matched the handwriting on the yellow business card found at the murder scene. Brownsville officers then headed to McKinney with a warrant revoking Sueller's bond. He showed up later at the bail office, unsure why his application was canceled. After police questioned him, he said that he had given the yellow business card to a man at the La Quinta Motel in Brownsville and told him to call that number if he was ever arrested. Investigators knew that this motel in downtown Brownsville was a meeting place for low-level criminals. The sheriff's office began investigating the people who had stayed at the motel in previous months. Sueller put the police in contact with Ramiro Moya, a San Antonio resident who frequented Brownsville, and claimed to know details pertaining to the murder. Moya led the police to his half-brother Daniel Orlando Garza, a San Antonio painter who frequented Brownsville and Mexico. Police interrogated Garza at a San Antonio motel in mid-March. Garza claimed to have a landscaping business in Mexico, though police suspected that he was a drug dealer. After further questioning, Garza incriminated himself and said that he had made arrangements to have Fisher killed. He told the police he confessed because he was troubled by what he had done. He was not arrested immediately because investigators needed more information from him to continue with the case. He told investigators that it started when he visited a local fortune teller after he separated from his wife in 1992. The fortune teller, Maria Mercedes Martinez de Sanchez, consulted with Garza for several sessions in an attempt to repair the relationship he had with his wife. Garza's son was born with muscular dystrophy and his wife was depressed, to the point where she wanted to kill herself and their son. Investigators said that Garza believed his wife's relatives had cast a spell on their marriage and he needed Martinez's help. They discovered that Martinez promised to help Garza if he agreed to help kill Fisher. Garza confirmed to the police Martinez was working with a client, aka Cisneros, who wanted Fisher, along with anyone who got in the way, dead. Cisneros visited her at least 3 times to consult with her after the breakup between Fisher and Christina. During their first meeting, Cisneros wanted to know if Fisher felt anything for her daughter. Martinez read through her cards and told her that he was no longer in love with Christina. Cisneros paid $5 for the card reading and left the shop upset with Martinez's answer. During their second meeting, Cisneros asked Martinez to cast a spell on Fisher. Martinez said she was unable to do that, and Cisneros grew angry and left the store. A few days later, Cisneros called Martinez and asked her to pray for Fisher to get back together with Christina. Cisneros returned for a third visit to Martinez's shop in October 1992 and asked if she knew anyone willing to beat up Fisher. By winter, she changed her request and asked to have Fisher killed, offering $3,000 to the person who would do it. According to Martinez, Cisneros told her that Fisher had raped Christina and was telling his classmates at St. Joe that he had sex with her. However, Christina said that she had never had sex with him. Although Garza assured Martinez that he would find someone to carry out the job, he kept calling and visiting her to discuss his marriage problems. Under pressure from Cisneros, Martinez would often interrupt the sessions with Garza to remind him of the plan. Garza lied to Martinez on several occasions, telling her he had someone lined up to kill Fisher. Cisneros contacted Martinez in November to ask her why the job had not been done. Martinez responded that she did not know when the murder would be carried out. Garza eventually divorced his wife on January 4, 1993, and kept calling Martinez to tell her his personal problems had not been fixed. On January 9th, he traveled to Brownsville from San Antonio to talk about the divorce, and Martinez reminded him that a client of hers wanted Fisher dead. She told him again that if he facilitated Fisher's murder, Garza's personal problems would be solved.
I'm just taking it in.
Yeah, keep going.
What in the world? Yeah. Like, come on.
Martinez contacted Garza, who knew two hitmen from Matamoros who could carry out the job. Cisneros then gave Martinez a photo of Fisher, who passed it on to Garza. Garza contacted Israel Olivares Cepeda and Herberto Puentes Pizana to carry out the murder.
You are killing it with these names. I'm just saying. I know you're nervous, but you got this.
Thanks. Garza had met them in Brownsville at Olivares' uncle's house. During the last week of January, Garza met them again at a restaurant in Grand Prairie, Texas, while he was working with Sueller and Moya. Garza told Olivares that there was a woman in Brownsville willing to pay someone to kill Fisher. Olivares said he was interested in the job and stayed in contact with Garza. Olivares and Puentes Pizana were part of a cross-border drug trafficking and car theft ring that stretched from Mexico to Chicago. This organization was headed by Sueller, the same man whose bond application was investigated by the Brownsville police after the business card was discovered at Fisher's house. Garza met the two again in Dallas on February 14th to describe the murder plans. They were given Fisher's photo, a map with the address, and promised that they would do as they had been told on their next trip to Brownsville. On March 2nd, the night before the murder, Garza was traveling from San Fernando, Tamaulipas, Mexico, to San Antonio and bumped into the two at a motel in Brownsville. Olivares asserted that he was ready to carry out the plan. According to U.S. border surveillance, a white Mercury Grand Marquis with Mexican license plates 821-THE-7 crossed at Brownsville border entry at 6:39 p.m. Central Time on March 2nd. This car had crossed to Brownsville from Matamoros 18 times between August of 1992 and March of 1993. When police went to the motel to check the register, they discovered that at 8:26 p.m. Central Time that evening, Puentes Pizana and Ramon Palomares, another hitman of the Sueller organization, checked in with the receptionist. She registered the car in her notebook as a white Grand Marquis, but it was unclear if she wrote 821-WEX or 821-THE-7 as the license plate number. Other evidence showed that several calls were made from Puentes Pizana's and Garza's rooms to an identical Dallas number on the day of the murder. The police were never able to connect the number with the investigation or identify the Dallas contact. Other evidence showed that Garza, along with Sueller and Moya, visited a gun shop in Dallas to purchase a .38 super pistol. After Fisher was killed, Garza said that the gun was stolen from his house in San Antonio after someone broke into it. The weapon was never recovered. Between 7 a.m. and 8 a.m. Central Time on March 3rd, the morning Fisher was killed, Olivares confirmed with Garza at the motel that the murder was successful. Garza then went to Martinez's shop to tell her the teenager was dead. She told Garza that she would not give him the money unless there was solid proof that Fisher was dead. Garza then talked with Olivares and Puentes Pizana at the motel room. A few hours after the murder, Martinez phoned Cisneros and told her that the job had been carried out. Cisneros arrived at her store minutes later and left a sealed envelope with the money. Cisneros then went to St. Joe and picked up her daughter from school. Later that evening, Garza and Puentes Pizana met with Martinez and picked up the envelope. They headed back to the motel, and Garza handed over the envelope to Olivares. Garza claims that the hitman received $3,500, though he stated he never counted the money. Martinez said she did, and that it was $3,000. Investigators believe it could have been as much as $5,000. Garza was then picked up by his nephew from Matamoros and taken to the Harlingen Airport, where he flew back to San Antonio. On his way to the airport, he passed through Rancho Viejo and recalled seeing police cars and a house cornered off with yellow tape.
This is a wild ride. Is this a movie?
No.
This should be a movie.
It should be a movie, but it's not. Not that I know of.
We need to do it. We're going to trademark this.
Yeah, right? What page am I on?
Jesus. This is a wild ride. Like, it wild, is. Wild. I think this is one of the wildest ones we've had.
Yeah.
So, maybe the wildest.
So, after Garza confessed to police in a written statement on March 31st, 1993, he was not arrested immediately because he agreed to cooperate with them in their efforts to apprehend Martinez. Garza reached out to Martinez and told her that the assassins wanted more money. He met with her three times in April of 1993 wearing a wire and had Martinez agree to contact Cisneros to give Garza the money. Police arrested Martinez on April 6th and agreed to work with them to incriminate Cisneros. The next morning, she scheduled a meeting with Cisneros and told her that the assassins requested more money and that she needed to pay. They rode around Brownsville and Cisneros' voice was recorded. The police kept close to the car to stay within the transmitter's signal range. Only portions of the conversation were recorded because the police were unable to remain within range all the time. While in the car, Cisneros gave Martinez an envelope with $500. Cisneros then asked Martinez if there was any evidence that she had orchestrated the murder. Cisneros mentioned Garza and a man known as El Cordado, though investigators had no idea who he was. Anyway, I don't know why I read that funny. In the recorded conversation, there was no incriminating evidence against the gunmen, since there was no evidence that Cisneros employed them or that the assassins murdered Fisher. The meeting concluded when police pulled the vehicle over and arrested Cisneros. She told a police officer that she owed Martinez some money, which Martinez later admitted was not the case. Cisneros and Martinez were arrested and charged with capital murder, which in Texas is punishable with a life sentence or death by lethal injection. Cisneros was taken to the Cameron County Jail. On her way there, reporters asked if she was responsible for Fisher's murder, and she shook her head. Cisneros' husband also refused to comment. The police denied her bail, but her attorney said that she was a respected member of the Brownsville community and deserved bail. Cisneros' attorney told the press that the arrest was...
the same person?
Yeah. Well, you have to remember, her husband's a surgeon, and she's played, like, the Miss Saint card forever.
True, true, true. I'm just saying, like, wow.
Right. Cisneros' attorney told the press that the arrest was a mistake and that he was confident the police had no solid evidence against her. Police responded by saying they were content with her arrest but still needed to go after other people involved in the murder plot. Martinez's family also said that they were shocked by the arrest, saying that they hoped it was a mistake and that they did not know the Fishers or the Cisneros. On April 13th, Cisneros was released from prison on a $300,000 bond, refusing to comment as she left. According to court documents, Cisneros did not go before a judge to obtain a bond. Her attorney reached an agreement with the Cameron County Court District after her bond was denied the week before. Martinez remained in prison, and her bond was set at the same amount the next day. Her lawyer stated that she deserved a bond as well because she was a senior citizen and had a clean criminal record. On June 8, 1993, Garza was arrested at the Cameron County office in Harlingen, having surrendered after an arrest warrant was issued. He was charged with capital murder and held at a county prison with a $500,000 U.S. bond. Garza refused to comment on the arrest, and officers stated that they could not release details of his involvement other than that they had evidence that he was involved in Fisher's murder. Arrest warrants were issued for Olivares and Puentes Pizana the day before. They were believed to be in Mexico, and police said that they were working with Mexican officials to arrest the two men. On July 21, 1993, Mexican State Judicial Police arrested Olivares and his brother Alonso Basaldúa Cepeda in Matamoros on a December 1992 murder charge and for the unauthorized use of a vehicle. However, both men were released at around 3 a.m. the next day after Olivares showed police the writ of amparo, which is similar to a writ of habeas corpus, which protected his constitutional civil rights. Following their release, the Brownsville police said that there were reports that the two suspects were seen in Matamoros and in Monterrey, Nuevo León, and that next time they tried to cross the international bridge, U.S. border agents would arrest them. Police records show that Olivares was once arrested in Brownsville on September 12, 1992 for possession of a criminal instrument, but was released on bond the following day. He wrote on his bond application that he lived in Brownsville, though this information was false. On February 13, 1994, state judicial police arrested Puentes Pizana in Reynosa, Tamaulipas on a car theft charge. In an interview the following day, he said he was not guilty of Fisher's murder and claimed that he was at his mother's house in Matamoros when the murder occurred. He insisted that neither he nor Olivares were gun owners or users. U.S. officials noted that it was unlikely for Mexico to extradite Puentes Bazana since the extradition treaty between both countries did not cover Mexican nationals, and because Texas was a death penalty, and because Texas has the death penalty, which is outlawed in Mexico. Reynosa officials stated that Puentes Bazana would have to face charges in Mexico before an extradition could be considered. Car theft sentences range from 3 to 10 years in prison. Puentes Bazana, on the other hand, argued that facing trial in the U.S. would not guarantee a fair trial. South Texas officials stated that there was a possibility that Puentes Bazana to... Wait. South Texas officials stated that there was a possibility for Puentes Bazana to be tried in Mexico for Fisher's murder if an agreement was made between Texan and Tamaulipas state officials, though they said that trying him in the U.S. was unlikely. Among the possible guarantees discussed for a possible extradition was dropping Puentes Bazana's capital murder charge altogether because it qualified him for the death penalty. Another alternative discussed was having U.S. authorities promise Mexican prosecutors that Puentes Bazana would not face the death penalty. Once in the U.S., Puentes Bazana's charges cannot be upgraded, per the 1980 extradition treaty between both countries. On May 23, 1994, Mexican state judicial police arrested Olivares again in Matamoros for possessing 2 stolen vehicles. He was interviewed by Mexican authorities and stated that he was not guilty of Fisher's murder. He admitted to having stolen the cars, to having stolen cars since he was young, and stated that Garza was trying to put the blame on him to protect himself from prosecution. Olivares justified himself by saying that he had never been arrested with a gun. He admitted going to Dallas in 1992, but stated that he only knew Garza by name. He said he was a self-employed auto mechanic who supported his wife, mother, and uncle. Mexican officials said that Olivares' auto theft ring extended all the way to Monterey, as well as in Rio Bravo, Villa Hermoso, and Matamoros, Tamaulipas. There was an arrest warrant for him issued by a state judge in Reynosa for being connected to about 50 car thefts. Brownsville investigators went to Mexico to see if they could talk to Olivares and began the extradition proceedings to bring him to a Texan court. So, it's still crazy. A state grand jury indicted Cisneros, Martinez, Garza, Olivares, and Puentes Pizana on July 28, 1993. Defense attorneys said that they wanted to move the trial out of Cameron County because the case had attracted a lot of media attention in the local area. Martinez's defense attorney said he wanted to file a motion to change the venue and have his client tried separately from the others accused. He also said that he would try to suppress a statement made by Martinez after she was arrested in April. On August 12th, in a packed courtroom at the 357th State District Courthouse in Brownsville, Cisneros and Martinez pleaded not guilty to the murder charges. Garza also entered a not guilty plea and stood with the accused during the court session. The judge agreed to remove La Curandera, which is a healer or fortune teller, from Martinez's name on the indictment after the defense complained that the alias was a media creation. The judge set the hearing date for pretrial motions for October 7th and the trial for November 8th. On September 20th, defense attorneys for Martinez and Garza filed motions to suppress statements their clients had made since March. Martinez's attorney said that she did not understand her right to have a lawyer because she is not fluent in English and that her arrest was unlawful. The defense asked the judge to discard the video and wiretap recordings because they claimed that their client was involuntarily coerced to make statements that incriminated her and thus violated the Miranda warnings. Martinez's defense requested a court-appointed translator, the elimination of the indictment, and a severance to their client tried separately. In addition, Garza's defense said that their client's constitutional rights were violated when he made his statements. They also said that Garza's encounter with Martinez after Fisher's murder was recorded without his knowledge. On October 27th, the defense attorneys again said that they wanted to move the venue for the trial outside Cameron County because of all the publicity the case had received. The claim was They claimed it was impossible to select an impartial jury in Brownsville because of the amount of information the press had released against the defendants. The judge said that he would announce his decision on November 2nd. On the same day, a grand jury reindicted Cisneros and Martinez on capital murder. Prosecutors had presented the evidence to a second grand jury and issued a revised indictment. A clear distinction between the first and second indictment was the change of the word caused to committed. Because a new indictment was issued, Cisneros, Martinez, and Garza pleaded not guilty for a second time, forcing the court proceedings to be pushed back from their original dates. A pretrial hearing scheduled for November 2nd was delayed. At least 42 motions were filed by defendants when the first indictment was made, and the second indictment meant that they had to refile all motions by November 12th. On November 23rd, Cisneros' request for a change of venue was denied by the court. The prosecution stated that the pool of possible jurors included people from other parts of Cameron County and not just from Brownsville, where most of the county's population resided, and where the murder had occurred. They stated it was unlikely that these potential jurors had read the articles from the Houston Chronicle, the Dallas Morning News, and the New Yorker magazine, which the defense provided earlier as evidence that Cisneros was depicted negatively. The trial was pushed ahead to January 31st, 1994. The day of the trial, Martinez admitted that she conspired to kill Fisher and agreed to testify against Cisneros and Garza. By entering a plea bargain, Martinez was seeking to be sentenced for a conspiracy charge and to have the capital murder charges dropped. The judge stated that he was not bound by the plea bargain agreement, but clarified that she had the right to drop her guilty plea if she so decided. Jury selection began on February 4th. Defense attorneys questioned the first potential jury group of 38 people. They chose two jurors on the first day of the selection hearing for Cisneros and Garza's trial. Martinez was no longer part of the proceedings since she pleaded guilty to conspiracy to murder on February 1st and agreed to testify for the prosecution against Cisneros and Garza. According to state law, a defendant cannot be sentenced based on the statement of an alleged accomplice. While interviewing the rest of the potential jurors, each defense attorney struck two potential jurors, as did the state. Two others were disqualified, but this did not affect the total number of strikes allowed. Each defendant was allowed 8 strikes, and the prosecution 16 for the two defendants. On February 7th, two more jurors were selected, bringing the total to 4 of the 12 jurors required, plus 2 alternate jurors. The judge said he was going to analyze whether he should drop Martinez's capital murder charge since she had pleaded guilty to conspiracy the week before. On February 11th, the defense attorneys were halfway through the jury selection after selecting a total of 7. On February 16th, 9 jurors had been selected, but the total number of strikes was reduced after 25 jurors were struck because they had preconceived opinions of the defendants. The defense had used 10 strikes between them and only had 6 left. The prosecution, on the other hand, had 8 strikes left. By February 23rd, 11 jurors had been selected. Only 2 open spots were available for jurors, and one being an alternate. Since the trial had received national attention, Brownsville officials were expecting a large crowd of spectators and reporters in the courtroom. In order to accommodate them, the trial was moved from the 357th State District Court to the 197th State District Courtroom. On February 25th, 1994, the jury examined the evidence from the bullet remains, the motel records, and photos of Fisher's corpse. Joey Fisher's brother Eric took the stand and described what he saw and heard the morning his brother was killed. He said he heard 2 gunshots, he looked through the window and saw a white car driving away. Fisher's sister Kathy told the jury that she and Christina had once had a 2-hour-long phone conversation and that Christina had said that she wanted to hurt Fisher. Their school counselor stated that Christina agreed she said this, but claimed that she did not mean it once she learned about Fisher's death. Christina told the jury that she did not remember making such statements to Kathy or the counselor. A member of the Sweller organization, Victor Moreno, testified in court and helped investigators connect the murder to members of the criminal group. He stated that Olivares, Puentes Pizana, and Palomares worked for Sweller and were behind the murder. He also said he spoke with Garza about, quote, a murder in Brownsville and claimed to have been with Sweller when Palomares called to tell him about the murder of a boy in Brownsville. Moreno allegedly gave money to Garza to buy the gun in Dallas on Sweller's behalf. After the purchase, Moreno gave the gun to Sweller, who then reportedly gave it to the assassins. The defense stated that even if, for argument's sake, Moreno's testimony was true, it was inadmissible because he was not involved in the murder itself. However, the court concluded that he was an integral part of the process that led to Fisher's murder and admitted his testimony, citing a co-conspirator hearsay exception. On February 28th, Garza's half-brother Moya testified against him and said Garza admitted he had received $3,000 for Fisher's murder while he was in Brownsville. Garza's defense tried to discredit Moya's statement by saying that he was facing drug offenses in Dallas and was cooperating with prosecutors by testifying against Garza to receive a reduced sentence. Moya denied such arrangements were in place. He said the gun used at the murder scene was bought in Dallas while he was there, and he remembered seeing it in Garza's home in San Antonio. Records from the gun shop in Dallas showed Garza bought the same type of gun on February 1st, 1993. In addition, a Drug Enforcement Administration investigator testified he helped record the suspect's conversations, while an FBI technician helped improve the clarity of the tapes. The defense attorneys brought in experts to discredit the recordings and to prove that they had been tampered with. On March 1st, defense attorneys questioned evidence brought by the prosecution. They pointed out that the police had no written reports of the investigation and had failed to record the serial numbers and mark the U.S. $100 bills used as evidence when Martinez received the cash from Cisneros immediately before her arrest. In addition, a private forensic investigator hired by the defense stated that he could not prove that the recordings were authentic. The private investigator later mentioned in an interview that the defense had paid $18,000 to analyze the tapes, though she said that this payment did not influence her study of the recordings. The defense said the searches police conducted did not produce any evidence to implicate Cisneros in the murder and that Garza was not arrested for over a month after he confessed his involvement in it. The police defended their actions and said that Garza was initially a witness when investigators met with him and Moya in March of 1993 at a motel in San Antonio to discuss the murder. Investigators said he then traveled with them to Brownsville to give an official statement, which he signed. He then stayed at a hotel in Brownsville that was arranged and paid for by the Brownsville investigators, while the police prepared to record his encounter with Martinez. After incriminating Martinez, Garza was allowed to go to Mexico. Martinez and Cisneros were arrested several weeks after Garza's statement, but he was not arrested until 2 months later. The police stated that they made no promises to Garza to obtain his cooperation. On March 3rd, the jurors listened to the voice recordings having been provided with a transcript. The transcript had inaudible written on some of the excerpts because the conversations during Garza's meeting with Martinez and during Martinez's meeting with Cisneros were unclear. On the first recording, Garza met with Martinez under the pretext that the gunmen were requesting more money and that the police instructed Garza to tell Martinez that Cisneros needed to pay an extra $500. On the recordings, Martinez told Garza that she had no money and that Cisneros was out of town. Garza then told Martinez that the assassins were difficult to contact and he worried that if the payments were not made that they would get angry. Martinez then asked Garza what the assassins did with the car they used and if they had worn gloves when they shot Fisher. After two more recordings between the pair, the Brownsville police arrested Martinez and had her meet with Cisneros. Early in the recording made with Cisneros, though unclear in some parts, she was recorded handing over something to Martinez and saying five, referring to the $500 the police confiscated from her during the arrest. She was recorded asking Martinez if there was any proof that she had been involved in the murder. The jury heard Cisneros' recording asking Martinez the following phrase, there isn't any evidence that I did anything. On March 5th, Martinez testified against Cisneros and told the jury that she ordered Fisher's murder. Martinez said that Cisneros told her to keep the plan a secret and that she wanted him good and dead. Speaking in Spanish through an interpreter, Martinez leaned forward in her seat and pointed at Cisneros, saying she told her exactly that. Defense attorneys tried to discredit Martinez's testimony and show the jury that she was a con woman. They presented letters from several of her former clients who had paid around $600 for love potions. One woman from San Antonio said that Martinez consulted her after she began having problems with her boyfriend and did not see positive results. Martinez denied knowing who the writers were, but changed her mind when the defense read the letters to her and the jury. She admitted that she used herbs, oils, and holy water in her sessions, and that she kept a human skull in her shop. She did not call herself a curandera or a fortune teller because she did not study to earn the title. Martinez was then asked to read her cards from one of the attorneys in the courtroom to show the jury how she worked. After 3 weeks of jury selection and 8 trial days, the defense made their closing statements on March 7th in about 3 hours. They presented 3 witnesses and then rested their cases. Fisher's mother took the stand and gave her final testimony and her version of the story. The judge told prosecutors that they had to choose to charge the defendants with capital murder or conspiracy to commit murder. The prosecution decided on the capital murder charge and sought the death penalty for both Cisneros and Garza. The following day, the jury convicted Cisneros and Garza of capital murder for arranging Fisher's death. Neither of them showed any emotion when the verdict was given. Cisneros then removed her jewelry and was taken to the Cameron County Jail with Garza. The jurors met the following day to discuss the punishment phase of the trial. On March 9th, the judge sentenced Cisneros and Garza to life in prison after the jury decided that neither of them posed a threat to society and thus did not deserve the death penalty. The sentence included the possibility for parole after they complete 35 mandatory years behind bars. The head juror said the tapes were the strongest evidence against them, along with Martinez's testimony. Fisher's parents said that they were pleased with the decision and that justice was finally served, but said that their son's absence would leave a void for the rest of their lives. The prosecution intended to have Cisneros sentenced to death, arguing that her actions were premeditated. Garza's closing words centered around him being told by Martinez that Cisneros wanted Fisher hurt and that he would not have knowingly participated in a murder. Both defense attorneys said that they would appeal the verdict. Cisneros' attorney in particular said that the judge's denial of a separate trial for his client was the reason for his early appeal. The defense said that the trials where two defendants implicate each other are often severed. The judge refused to sever them because Cisneros' statement did not mention Garza. The defense also said that they would appeal the verdict because they believed that the voice recordings were tampered with and unauthenticated. A judge formalized the jury's decision and sentenced Cisneros and Garza to life in prison on April 18th. On March 25th, Martinez was sentenced to 20 years in prison for conspiracy to commit murder. The judge recognized that although she was of an advanced age and might not leave prison alive before her sentence was completed, in his judgment, the punishment was appropriate. She was given the maximum sentence. The shortest sentence was 2 years. Martinez's lawyer said that if her client had not pleaded guilty and cooperated with court officials, her sentence would probably have been the same as Cisneros' and Garza's. He also said that she would not be eligible for parole in 18 to 24 months because the murder weapon was never found. Oh, that she would be eligible for parole. Sorry. If the murder weapon had been found, Texas law required all individuals convicted in a murder case to serve at least 1/4 of their sentence before being eligible for parole. Both Cisneros and Martinez were sent to the all-female state prison Gatesville unit. Kept in separate cells while Garza was confined in Cameron County Prison. On July 13, 1995, Cameron County officials and state authorities traveled to Mexico City to ask Mexican officials to prosecute Puentes Pizana and Olivares for Fisher's murder. Thousands of documents were translated from English to Spanish and handed over to Mexico's Attorney General for review. On July 15th, Mexican officials agreed to prosecute both of them for the murder in an international prosecution court in Mexico City. Texas prosecutors asked the Mexican government to use Article 4 of the Mexican Federal Penal Code, a little-used provision that permits Mexican citizens to be prosecuted in Mexico for crimes they committed outside the country. In order for the provision to take effect, it required the accused to be in Mexican territory, not to have faced justice in the country where the crimes were committed, and that the crime was not only illegal in the country where it was committed, but also in Mexico. Murder in Mexico carries a maximum sentence of 50 years in prison, though it's common for people to be released after 15 to 25 years for good behavior. The Cameron County office said that they would use a federal prosecutor from Tamaulipas as the judge. The two accused would be issued an arrest warrant and asked to appear in court where a federal judge would review their case and determine the punishment in a few months. When Puentes Pizana heard the news, he was surprised and angered by the decision. He maintained his innocence, saying he was only a car thief. Olivares was in custody in Matamoros Prison. On September 20th, a Mexican federal judge agreed to prosecute Puentes Pizana and Olivares for the murder. Both of them were eventually found guilty and sentenced to 15 years in prison.
They should be.
I'm almost done.
You're fine.
Kind of. On January 25th, 1996, Cisneros' conviction was overturned by the Court of Appeals for the 13th District of of Texas in Edinburgh, Texas. In court, the judge instructed the jury that unless there was evidence showing that Cisneros employed the assassins, or that there was evidence that Puentes Pizano and Olivares killed Fisher, she could not be convicted of capital murder. The jury had no evidence that Cisneros had hired the assassins, since her only contact was through Martinez. The jury analyzed the circumstantial evidence that linked Puentes Pizano or Olivares to the murder. They knew the pair registered at the motel the night before the murder and left the motel a few hours after Fisher was killed. They also heard they drove a car similar in description as the one seen at the crime scene and made several phone calls to the same Dallas number as Garza after the killing, and that Garza said he paid the assassins at a motel. The evidence cast suspicion on the two alleged hitmen, but was not enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Puentes Pizano or Olivares were behind Fisher's murder. The court also recognized that even if Puentes Pizano or Olivares were found guilty of the murder, there was not enough evidence to show that Cisneros employed the two or was ever in contact with them. The jury recognized there was evidence that she gave money to Martinez, who in turn gave it to Garza, but that meant that there were several parties at fault. In order for the jury to find Cisneros responsible for the actions of another party, the judge needed to charge the jury on the Texas law of parties that she was acting a party to the offense. Prosecutors agreed that Cisneros was guilty under the law of parties and that she was guilty of the crime of murder, even though she did not commit the crime directly. However, prosecutors failed to word her charge appropriately, suggesting that Cisneros directly hired Puentes Pizano and Olivares to murder Fisher instead of working through intermediaries. On February 14th, a state appeals court in Corpus Christi ordered Cisneros' release on a $50,000 bond, about one-sixth of the original bond posted for her trial. The order stated that the prosecution did not agree to the bail, but the document stated that they had failed to file the appropriate paperwork within the mandatory 10 days. On February 22nd, a judge ordered her released from prison. She was unavailable for comment, and it was not known if she returned to Brownsville. Fisher's family denounced the ruling and said the appeals court seemed to have lost sight that their son had been killed. Brownsville prosecutors said even if there was not enough evidence to convict Cisneros for capital murder, she could still be convicted of ordinary murder, since the appeal was approved because there was no direct evidence linking Cisneros with a murder-for-hire charge. The reversal was upheld by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in November of 1996. All right. I'm almost done.
I give you credit because you have just really went for it. Like, this is a wild ride. I'm just sitting here, like, you can tell by my face, I'm sure. Like, I'm just, like,
yeah,
taking it in. Like,
it just keeps going. So, after 2 years, Cisneros was rearrested on February 25th, 1998, and held without bond. According to county jail records, she was arrested for the same murder-for-hire charges as the first time. The FBI did not elaborate initially on the charges, but stated that she had indicted by a federal grand jury for using interstate and foreign commerce facilities to orchestrate the murder. The indictment's hearing was held 2 weeks before the statute of limitations ran out. Cameron County officials said that charging Cisneros again was not double jeopardy, which does protect individuals from being charged for the same crime more than once, because she was already charged federally. They argued the new indictment included new charges not discussed in the previous trial, and that there are some areas that allow for concurrent jurisdiction that can lead to someone being charged for separate crimes under the same circumstances. If convicted again, Cisneros was facing another life in prison sentence and a $250,000 fine. Her defense stated that they would not plead guilty and ask for a jury trial. The prosecution said that Martinez agreed to serve as their primary witness again. The defense criticized the new indictment, stating it was vague and did not include new information. On March 2nd, the defense argued in court that Cisneros should be set free on bond during the trial because she did not pose a flight risk as demonstrated by her actions during the first trial. The defense stated that she never failed to appear in court during the 1994 trial, even though she was facing a possible death penalty. In addition, they said she was a longtime resident of Brownsville and had no previous criminal history. Though Cisneros was aware of the FBI investigation and the possibility of a new indictment against her, she had not fled, thus justifying her bond. On March 9th, Cisneros was released from jail on a $300,000 bond. The court ruled for the defense after deciding that she would not attempt to flee before the trial. Court officials imposed certain restrictions on her freedom, however. They asked her to hand over her U.S. passport and to limit her travel to the Brownsville and McAllen, Texas judicial districts. Her husband was also required to sign a document that made him a third-party custodian. On April 1st, the defense asked for the new trial to be moved outside Brownsville, claiming their client had received unfair treatment in the media and there was no chance for her to have a fair trial and an unbiased jury. The request included large numbers of magazines and newspaper articles published since 1993. It did not cite any specific passages where the alleged media bias was demonstrated. The defense also filed a motion to throw out the new indictment on the grounds that it was double jeopardy. On April 27th, the new judge decided to postpone his decision about where to hold the trial. He also rejected the defense's motion, stating that the new indictment was a case of double jeopardy. The defense agreed that the prosecution had illegally used Brownsville and Houston grand juries to work on the case, but the judge countered that the claim, saying only the Houston grand jury had handled the case. On May 4th, the trial was moved from Brownsville to Houston, Texas, because of the earlier extensive media coverage. In an opening statement for the trial on May 4th, Cisneros, this is in 1998, by the way, in an opening statement for the trial on May 4th, Cisneros' defense denied her client's participation in the murder and called Martinez a liar. They stated that Martinez and Garza orchestrated the murder without Cisneros' involvement. The prosecution told the jury that Cisneros orchestrated the murder. Fisher's mother took the stand and repeated her versions of the story of the two loud noises she heard before finding her son's corpse covered with blood on the driveway. In addition to her, other witnesses took the stand to tell the jury their stories, including his stepfather and a gardener who saw a vehicle with Mexican license plates leaving the house when Fisher was shot dead. Martinez testified in court again that Cisneros agreed to pay her to find someone to murder Fisher after Martinez told her that he was not in love with her daughter. Investigators who worked on the case also testified in court and stated that Martinez cooperated with them to set up a meeting with Cisneros after she assisted her in finding someone to have Fisher killed. The prosecution stated they had audio tapes of Martinez's meeting with Cisneros, but they were asked to hold off on presenting the evidence because the defense stated the tapes were tampered with. The recordings were admitted to court on May 8th and presented to the jury through translated transcripts. The prosecution brought forward bank statements that showed Cisneros' withdrawal of $5,000 from a $100,000 family safety deposit box on July 2, 1992 and March 3, 1993, the morning Fisher was killed. The defense stated that there was nothing illegal about visiting the safety deposit box or marking the withdrawal. They stated that the $5,000 was for a family trip to Mexico. The prosecution suggested that the money was to pay off the murderers, but they were unable to prove evidence linking the two actions. On May 11th, the defense introduced two witnesses to rest their case after 6 days of prosecution arguments. Most of the testimonies from the prosecution that day were done by Garza, who stated that Martinez never mentioned Cisneros' name as the person she was working with to have Fisher killed. Garza stated that he consulted Martinez on his marriage, but that she would interrupt to ask him if he had found anyone who was willing to carry out her other client's request and hurt Fisher. Garza claimed that he had at least four calls from phone booths in San Fernando and Matamoros, which are two Mexican cities. The defense stated that Garza told the FBI that he had made collect calls, but Garza said that they were mistaken. He said that making collect calls from Mexico was difficult, though he did not discard the possibility of having made one to Martinez. The prosecution did not enter evidence showing that Garza made calls from Mexico to the U.S., and one of the defense witnesses showed that Martinez's phone bill did not have any collect calls from Matamoros. The defense stated that Garza made the claim of the phone calls from Mexico to get a reduced sentence, while Garza responded that he was testifying to make sure everyone involved in the murder gets punished. The defense responded by showing the jury letters from Garza's jail stating that he was willing to cooperate with the FBI in the trial for a reduced sentence. Garza responded by saying that those letters were written by one of the English literate inmates on his behalf. The other defense witness was a restorer? I don't know. Restorator, who saw Cisneros a few hours after the murder and recalled seeing her behaving normally. The federal jury convicted Cisneros of the murder on May 12, 1998, after 3 hours of deliberation. The prosecution introduced witnesses, including the motel manager and those at the crime scene, who stated that they saw a white car driven by the suspected assassins coming from Mexico the day before the shooting. The defense told the jurors that there was not enough evidence to uphold the conviction under federal requirements of reasonable doubt. The government concluded that it met the burden of proof for interstate or foreign commerce charges in two ways. Through Garza's phone calls from Mexico and through the matching license plates from the Mexican car that crossed into the U.S. and registered at the motel, which matched the description of the vehicle seen at the murder scene. In order to find Cisneros guilty, they were not required to prove that she intended to use interstate or foreign commerce, or even that she knew it would be used. They were required to prove that someone involved in Fisher's murder used interstate and foreign commerce or caused another person to use it. On July 27th, the jury rendered their final verdict and sentenced Cisneros to life in prison. 2 years later, the United States Attorney Office recognized two local police officers and three FBI agents for assisting in her prosecution. On February 24th, 2000, the United States Court of Appeal for the Fifth Circuit, acting sua sponte, or on their own accord, decided to rehear Cisneros' sentence en banc, which means before the entire court. After reviewing the case, they reaffirmed the conviction on January 4th, 2001. A petition for a rehearing was denied by the court on February 2nd, 2001. Her defense filed a writ of certiorari, seeking a judicial review on April 4th, 2001. On June 19th, 2001, Cisneros' defense filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court to review her conviction and have it overturned. They claimed that the U.S. federal government did not have jurisdiction over her case because there was no evidence of foreign commerce to invoke federal jurisdiction. Cisneros' attorney stated that the evidence brought forward from the prosecution showed that the murder arrangements were made in Texas and that the murderers traveled from Dallas to Brownsville, not Mexico, before the murder. Since the U.S. Supreme Court only reviews a few hundred cases out of thousands of requests it receives each year, the appeal was Cisneros' last attempt to have her conviction overturned. The Fifth Circuit refused to consider the appeal on October 3rd, 2001. The U.S. Supreme Court The U.S. Supreme Court denied her request for an appeal a second time on November 10th, 2008, bringing the case to full closure. According to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Cisneros was jailed in the Federal Correctional Institution in Tallahassee, Florida. She is now at the Federal Medical Center Carswell, with, and it gives a number, BOP number 77877-079. Years after her imprisonment, she maintained that she did not order Fisher's murder. Martinez, a non-U.S. citizen subject to deportation as a result of her conviction, was released from prison in April 2001 and later died in Matamoros. Garza, who was sentenced to life in prison, turned to religion and became a devout Catholic. In a letter written to the press in 2013, he thanked God for saving his life after two ruptured stomach ulcers and a heart attack that nearly killed him in 2012. He was imprisoned at the age of 42 and will not be eligible for parole until June 2028, when he will be 78 years old. He has spent time in several Texas prisons, including the Lewis C. Powledge Unit, the Terrell Unit, and the Eastham Unit. Inside the gymnasium of Fisher's former school is a gold plaque that reads, "May the serenity of the peaceful oceans and the warmth of the deep blue skies embrace you in the realms of heaven. May you light heavenly skies with love and enthusiasm as you lit ours for 18 years. May the angels welcome you with open arms and joyous voices. We love you, Joey, class of 1993 and 1994.
That was a wild ride.
I told you, it was 17 pages. But that is ultimately the murder of Joey Fisher.
That was a wild ride.
And mind you, this all started because he didn't want to be with this woman's daughter anymore.
And they were babies. Like, he just, they were...
And her daughter had a new boyfriend.
Right. Her daughter obviously was over it.
But I thought that was crazy. And and the fact that they had to try her like three times in order to get it to stick.
Wow. Wow, that's all I can say is wow.
Yeah, everything's bigger in Texas.
Yeah, including the murder cases.
That was a lot of...
I figured they were going to have issues with the...
Letting so cool air in.
I figured they were going to have issues with the guys from Mexico. Because I knew Mexico would not extradite if there was a potential for the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Because... I remember that from the Maybelline case. Remember the guy that was the Maybelline?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dog the Bounty Hunter.
And they can't extradite him because he was facing life.
They couldn't.
Murder. Lethal injection.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, he had so many like rape charges and stuff against him that there was a potential that he could be get the death penalty or and something like, and they would not extradite him for that cause. So Dog the Bounty Hunter illegally went to Mexico, arrested him, and then he had to go back to Mexico to face criminal charges there because he got that guy and brought it back. So, but yeah.
I think that's the longest case I've done.
That's great. Like, it was great though.
Thank you.
So,
Thank you.
hope you guys enjoyed.
Yeah,
I did.
I don't think you have to Google anything
Yeah,
on
you
that
shouldn't have to
one.
Google anything on
That
that
one should
one.
be good, but that's the murder of Joey Fisher.
So we'll be coming back Thursday
Yep.
with Texas again, and I'm covering the Texas killing field.
I'm super excited about this just because you threw me for a loop on something else with that, so.
Yeah. So anyway,
Because I don't know anything about these killing fields, apparently.
these killing fields are wild, but literally it's I kind of shortened it. I'm just gonna give like a brief synopsis of the people. Like, you're gonna learn a little bit about them and what
I
happened
gave you
because,
the, I was the
yeah.
epitome of long story short, as I give you the entire
Let's see.
movie
Hold
with
on.
subtitles and credits.
Hold on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34 people. 34 people.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm ready. I
And
talked your
that's just
ear
the
off.
victims.
Yeah, I talked your ear off, so it's your turn to talk my ear off with these.
So, have a good evening. Enjoy. Hope you listened.
Check out our Facebook, TikTok, Instagram,
Patreon,
Patreon.
all the things.
And yeah, any parting words for the fans?
Definitely lock your doors and don't hire a hitman
From Mexico.
from Mexico. And,
Or in
like,
general.
don't be that weird.
Yeah, and don't worry about what your kids are doing and if their high school boyfriends break up with them, because it ain't that serious.
Right.
Trust
Listen.
me, if I married the guy that I dated in high school, I would be upset. Anyway.
As long as they're not knocked up, you're okay. Just let it go. Elle said.
Yeah. And as always, there's probably something sinister right in your own backyard.
Bum ba da bum.